Let's go ahead and get back into the story of the battle of David and Goliath. It's in 1 Samuel chapter number 17. We're going to pick up at verse number 40. I particularly love this story now after I've been to this valley a couple of times now. The last visit that we made back in 2019, we were able to get down into the gully that I've been describing that goes down the middle of the Valley of Elah. We went into an area probably about 3/4 of a mile downstream from where the battle actually took place. But I have a good sense of what it would be like to climb down into this gully because I've done that, and what it looks like down at the bottom. Nowadays, Israel has pretty strict erosion controls. So I'm guessing that this gully does not get torn up by the winter rains in exactly the same way it used to back in the days of David. So if anything, it would have been even more rough and rugged down in the bottom of it. But I just got the photos out that I took the last time I was there, and it's basically just a whole bunch of loose rocks of various sizes, limestone rocks. Littered all over the bottom of this gully, and then each side is a pretty steep slope up and out of it. At the bottom, I think where we were at, maybe 8 feet deep from the bottom, from the level of the field above down to the bottom of the stream bed, and it was probably 10 feet wide from lip to lip, where we were at. So something of that neighborhood or something of that nature. And that's the reason why neither one of the armies wanted to cross it. It was difficult terrain that would have put the army entering into that area on a great disadvantage. And so that's why there was the 40-day standoff. And that is why Goliath was trying to convince the Israelis to stand forth a champion. And now David is coming forth as that champion, someone that Goliath never would have expected the Israelis to send his direction. So let's start our context in 1 Samuel 17:40 about David. He took his staff in his hand, so that's his shepherd's staff, and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook. And I picked out 2 stones that I brought home with me as souvenirs. I got them a little bit larger, I think, than what David would have chosen. He would have had something that could fit in the palm of his hand comfortably, that would have been fairly spherical, nice and aerodynamic, because he wants these stones to fly true when he slings them out of the pouch of his sling. So he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook. Don't know why 5. Some people have suggested it's because Goliath had 4 other giants associated with him, and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So that means David climbed down from the north, because that's the side the Israeli army is on, picked out his stones, then climbed up on the other side, on the south side. And as soon as he pops up out of there and starts walking south toward Goliath, that's when Goliath sees him. Verse 41. The Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. That is, he looked at him. You know, at a distance, he saw a figure coming toward him and thought, ah, finally, they're sending me a warrior. But as he got closer, he realized this is no warrior. This is a kid. So he disdained him, for he was but a youth. David is probably only about 12, maybe 13, I think, at this time. He was ruddy, meaning probably he has red or reddish yellow, you know, that strawberry blonde type of hair, and handsome in appearance. And he has no armor on. He's just in his normal workaday work clothes. And he has a stick in his hand and a sling that's kind of hanging down from his hand as well. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" Because that's a reference to the rod. And Goliath is insulted that they sent a kid. And so the Philistine cursed David by his gods. So he starts saying all sorts of things about what Dagon is going to do to him and all, and what Dagon's going to do to the Israelis and stuff along that line. So David responds because David understands this is not just single combat between a man from the Philistines and a man from the Israelis. This is all about who is truly God and who are truly the people of that God. So the Philistine said to David, "Come to me. I'm going to give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. So I'm going to kill you and feed you to the carrion." Verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of He who is over the armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." So how dare you? How dare you treat God as nothing and treat His people as nothing? You think you're heavily armed? Well, I'm coming here with the power of God. Verse 46, this day he who is, and he keeps saying the name of God here, because this is all about Dagon versus he who is. This day he who is will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down, and I will cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth and to all the earth, and that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that he who is saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is he who is's, and he will give you into my hand, or into our hand, because now he's speaking on behalf of Israel as well. So David is making this a matter of faith. He says, this is all about who God is. And God is going to feed your body and the bodies of all your associates over there behind you to the wild animals. Because God doesn't need swords and spears and shields and javelins to win. God is going to defeat you by a kid with a slingshot. Verse 48. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle lines to meet the Philistine. So Goliath is incensed at this point that this kid, without any armor, without any real weaponry, thinks that he's going to defeat him. So he's going to go and make mincemeat out of him fast. So he starts moving quickly toward David. David starts running back toward him. And that's when verse 49 happens. David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, and slung it. So he's got that whole mechanism going on here. The way that slingshots work is centrifugal force. You put that stone in the pocket that's between the two straps, and you whirl it around your head at a nice rapid pace. And once you get to velocity speed that you want, you let go at just the right moment one of the straps. And all that force that's been going round and round and round and round is now translated into straight line force. And slingers are very effective long range warriors in battle. And they can account for a lot of casualties in a short period of time if the other side is not protected against it. And so David lets fly this first stone, which is smaller than the palm, a cupped palm of my hand. That's about how big it would have been. You wouldn't want it to hit you. And so that stone flies and it lands exactly where God wants it to land. It struck the Philistine on his forehead. Now, this Philistine has armor all from his neck down to below his thighs. He's got shin straps on. He's got some of this armor that goes down probably past his elbow on each side. He's got a bronze helmet that sits down over his head, that's probably just above his eyebrows and down around his face and on each side of his head and down on the back of his neck. So he's pretty well covered against any type of weaponry that's used against him. But his biggest weaponry, his biggest defense is the fact he's monstrous. He's 9.5 feet tall and is proportionally wide as well. So this stone hits him in the perfect place to bring him down instantly. It lands right on the bridge of his nose, right between the eyes. And it sinks in. It says the stone sank into his forehead, which means it shattered all of that bone between the two eye orbits and shoved that right into the forefront of his brain. And he wouldn't have been dead instantly, but he would have been instantly incapacitated and dying. And so he probably fell face forward at the moment the stone hit him. And that is when David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling. That's what it says, verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. So David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. So David goes in and finishes the job. He doesn't have a sword of his own. So he runs up on the body of this monster and reaches down and pulls his own personal sword out of its sheath because Goliath was planning on using his sticking spear. And then whacks his head off with it. And then, more than likely, as is so often shown in illustrations and done in the movies and things, probably lifted that head up above his head so that the Philistines can see who won the fight. That there is no coming back from this. This guy is dead and has no head. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Now, what happened to the deal? You remember the deal? The deal was whichever champion wins, the other side gives up and becomes the slaves. So apparently, the Philistines had no intention of keeping that deal if they lost. They didn't think they were going to lose, but they definitely don't want to keep the deal now. So they start running. And they start running back downstream toward the Mediterranean, down along this wadi, this riverbed, that's going to take them back to Gath, back to Ekron, back to Ashdod, back to wherever it is their particular Philistine unit came from. And that's when the Israelis get into the act. Now, I would love to have been there. I would have loved to seen and heard the reaction. To see the Philistines all cheering when they see their guy moving ahead, he's going to go up there and squash this kid. And then probably this dead silence when they saw their guy go down. Maybe at first they thought he fell. Maybe they went, ooh. Maybe they had that groan that went up. But then the next thing they see is the little guy running up on their guy's body, doing that hacking motion and holding a head up. And that's, I think, when the dead silence ends. And the Philistines start saying, "Run!" And they take off. Now, Israel had to have had some similar reaction. They're watching a kid take on this giant. And he runs toward the giant falls down, and then the head goes up, and they would have started cheering. And then they would have realized the Philistines are running away. We've got to win the battle against the retreating Philistines. So, verse 52, the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron. So, those are the two cities closest to the battlefield. We're talking about less than 10 miles, I think. And so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'arayim as far as Gath and Ekron. So all along the retreat route from this battle place in the Valley of Elah, along the stream bed or along the edge of the stream, along the paths that go up and over the hill that's on the on either side of this stream bed, the Israelis are catching up and killing the retreating Philistines. And so there's corpses everywhere. And they chase them in this fashion, killing quite a few of them until whatever remained of this original invasion force has reached the gates of Gath and Ekron and gone in and shut the doors, and the Israelis can't get to them anymore. Verse 53. The people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines and they plundered their camp. So they do exactly what ancient militaries always did. You take the stuff of the losing side into your possession, and it gets divided up amongst all of those that fought on that day. Now, there's no reason to believe there were any Israeli casualties on this day. So 100% of the battle force that came out 40 days ago is now dividing up the spoil. And they are excited and they are happy. Verse 54, David took the head of the Philistine, and he's going to make this a war trophy that will follow him for the next couple of decades until he gets established at Jerusalem. It says here that he brought it to Jerusalem. Now, he won't come to Jerusalem as king over the united Israel until about the 8th year of his reign. And so we've still got about 17 years left of Saul's reign. So a couple of decades into the future before David ever brings it. Now, what does he do? And this is my guess, folks. That's all it's worth, all right? My guess is that he had it cleaned up so that there was no flesh on it anymore, and made sure that the stone stayed in place, embedded there in the skull, where it shattered the bones between the eyes and kind of just got stuck into the brain case area. And so I think that he probably let it get down to just bone and had it on display to show this is Goliath's skull with the stone still in place where God gave victory over the Philistines. Now, wouldn't that be quite the museum piece? Now, he put his armor in his tent. Excuse me. So Goliath's armor becomes David's personal property because he killed Goliath. Now, David will not be able to wear it unless he has it adjusted by quite a bit, but it certainly can be a trophy which warriors often display in their place of residence. So he probably puts on an armor stand this armor of the Philistine. Verse 55. Now, we got to do the wrap up to the battle. There are some verses here that are not original to the inspired text, I don't believe. Now, you've got it in your Bible. I understand that. But if you do some work on it, you'll find out that this whole section, verses 55 through 58, does not occur in the Septuagint or Greek version of the Old Testament. Now, why is that important? Because the Greek Septuagint was translated from the Hebrew that existed in the 3rd century BC. That's 300 years before the New Testament period. So the oldest texts that we have of the Old Testament, which happen to be Greek, don't have this in it. And so I don't believe it existed 300 years before Jesus. I think somebody, some Jewish person, wrote this up later for whatever reason and added it into the Greek or to the Hebrew texts that came down and got used by our English translators. So I'm going to read it to you, but I don't believe it's inspired. Got it? Am I clear enough on that? And I'll give you another reason why I don't think it is as well, because of the content. Verse number 55. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" Now that doesn't make any sense, does it? Because in the clear, unambiguous, inspired text, Saul knows David. He's interacted with him on a personal basis a lot. And so why in the world do we have this story where it acts where Saul doesn't seem to know David? Now, Abner is Saul's cousin, and who is the commander-in-chief of the Israeli armies. And he says back, "As your soul lives, O king, I don't know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." Now, none of that makes sense in what we already know about David and King Saul. Abner certainly would have been inside of Saul's inner circle, and his inner circle was the one that hired David to come and be Saul's musician. So it does not seem to be original to the original Hebrew. It seems to have been added in probably at some point after the 3rd century BC. Verse 57 is still part of that. As soon as David returned from the striking down the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." So I don't believe 55 to 58 is part of God's inspired word. So let's throw it off to the side. If I were translating the Old Testament, I would probably put a footnote at this point and leave it out of the text. So instead, we pick up the fallout in verse 1 of chapter 18. As soon as he finished speaking to Saul, so as soon as David was done with his post-battle interview with Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. So Jonathan, who we know is a man of God, I mean, he's the one that started the Philistine fight a couple of years earlier by saying, God doesn't need a whole bunch of people to win. If he wants to, he can use one or two. And so he was the hero of the battle that day. So he's a God, he's a man after God's own heart. Jonathan probably has met David, but thought of him like as a kind of a kid until this happened. Now he's seen David have more faith than he has, because Jonathan didn't volunteer to go and fight Goliath. Jonathan is somewhere in his 20s, I believe. So he's kind of a peer of David's older brothers. And so Jonathan is so impressed with David's faith that he becomes kind of David's big brother, his honorary big brother. He takes him under his wing and they become close personal friends. Now, at this point, I am going to rail angrily against those idiots that seem to insist that David and Jonathan had some sort of homosexual love affair. Garbage. They are close friends because they both love God and trust Him. And they, because they have the same heart toward God, are naturally going to become close personal friends. Verse number two. Well, I'm not done yet. How dare you suggest immoral behavior on the behalf of two men of God? All right, now I'm done. Verse 2. Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Remember, before he was going back and forth. Well, that was because he wouldn't take David to battles. Well, David has just proved himself to be a warrior before his time. So it doesn't matter that he's a kid. It is clear that he needs to start getting full military training. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt. So Jonathan says basically to David, David, you're someone that I want to help. I'm going to treat you with great respect and honor. I'm going to give you my own personal royal robe, and I want you to accept it as a gift from me. I also want you to accept my armor as your first suit of armor, and we'll get it, fixed to you. And I want you to take my weapons as your weapons. I want you to embark on your military career with my stuff. And so this is the beginning of a long personal relationship between the Prince of Israel and the future King of Israel.